So picture this. It's 1966, and there's this architect who is just completely, entirely stuck.
Oh, yeah, the classic creative block.
Exactly. I mean, he's been agonizing over building design for months, right? Nothing is working. And he walks into this room at a research institute in Menlo Park, California.
Right.
He swallows a capsule containing mescaline, and he just spends the day focusing on this block. And he walks out later with a fully completed blueprint.
A blueprint that actually ended up getting built in the real world, too.
Which is wild. And that single moment is just one tiny fraction of this massive cultural legend we have right now. You hear it literally everywhere today.
Oh, absolutely, everywhere.
You know, the story of Francis Crick supposedly visualizing the double helix structure of DNA while he was on LSD.
Right, or Steve Jobs.
Yes. Steve Jobs famously calling his own psychedelic experiences like one of the most important things he ever did in his life.
Yeah, and it hasn't stopped. I mean, look at today.
Right. Now you have an entire generation of Silicon Valley engineers, painters, songwriters, and they all swear by this daily practice of microdosing just to, keep your creative edge. The whole narrative is that these compounds are like a magic skeleton key for human genius.
It is a really seductive narrative, isn't it? I mean, we are all looking for a shortcut to peak performance.
Oh, 100%.
We want to believe there's this hidden door in our own minds, and that if we just find the right chemical combination, it'll just blow the hinges right off that door.
Just instant access to genius.
Exactly. Granting us access to some boundless well of original thought. But, you know, every myth survives because it contains a seed of truth.
Right.
But that truth is almost always wrapped in heavy layers of wishful thinking, confirmation bias, and, well, cultural projection.
Which brings us to today. Because today we are taking a magnifying glass to the actual neuroscience of all that inspiration.
Getting under the hood.
Exactly. We've got a massive stack of research today for this deep dive. It's anchored by a really incredible in-depth explainer that was published just today, August 3, 2026, in the OOTW Journal.
It's a great piece.
It really is. It's titled Psychedelics and Creativity: What the Science Really Says. And our mission here isn't to just dismiss the legends. Those stories of breakthroughs are compelling for a really good reason.
Yeah, we're not here to say those experiences weren't meaningful.
Right. Our goal is to measure the mechanics. We want to separate the fairy tale from the physical reality of what actually happens inside the brain's hardware when these compounds are introduced.
Because to understand the modern obsession with these compounds, we really have to look closely at the origin of the scientific inquiry itself.
Okay, let's unpack this because
Yeah.
that 1966 experiment you mentioned, the one at the Menlo Park Research Institute, that's really the anchor point, right?
It absolutely is. Willis Harmon and James Fadiman designed this study that honestly effectively launched the modern microdosing movement, even though, you know, they were using full macrodoses at the time.
Right, they weren't taking tiny amounts.
No, not at all. And they didn't recruit college students looking for a weekend trip. They specifically went after 27 highly established professionals.
Yeah, the demographic breakdown in the OTW Journal piece is fascinating. I mean,
Yeah.
we were talking about practicing engineers, mathematicians, architects, and artists.
I think there's even a furniture designer in there.
Yeah, a furniture designer. And the prerequisite for entry into this study was that every single one of them had to bring a real-world professional problem that they were entirely gridlocked on.
Right. These were not abstract logic puzzles handed out by a guy in a lab coat.
No.
Yeah.
These were structural engineering flaws and design dilemmas they had wrestled with for like weeks or months without making any progress whatsoever.
They were experiencing profound professional frustration. I mean, they were stuck. So Harmon and Fadiman administered a dose of mescaline to these 27 individuals,
Okay.
and they placed them in a highly supportive, carefully curated setting for the day, and the only instruction was to focus entirely on those stubborn problems.
And the subjective reports from the participants are just intense. The text notes this near universal drop in psychological inhibition.
Yeah, the anxiety just sort of melted away.
Exactly. The anxiety surrounding their failure to solve the problem vanished. And they described this sudden ability to view their specific narrow problem within a much broader context.
Along with rich visual imagery.
Yeah. And an incredibly free, frictionless flow of ideas.
And it wasn't just subjective feelings. Several participants actually arrived at concrete, viable solutions to problems they had been agonizing over.
Like the architect from the intro.
Exactly like the architect. The solutions weren't just drug-induced delusions of grandeur. They were mathematically sound, practically applicable answers that, you know, were later built and implemented.
Okay, wait. Hold on a second. I got to play devil's advocate here.
Go for it.
You take 27 highly stressed professionals in the 1960s. You pull them out of their demanding offices, take away the ringing phones, remove the pressure of their bosses breathing down their necks, and you place them in a quiet, dedicated, supportive retreat for an entire day to think about one single thing.
I see where you're going with this.
Right. Like, wouldn't anyone have a breakthrough in that environment? Are we really sure the mescaline caused the breakthrough and not just the psychological relief of a focused retreat?
You are targeting the exact methodological flaw that modern neuroscientists point out regarding that era of research.
Uh-huh.
By today's clinical standards, that 1966 study was entirely uncontrolled.
Because there was no baseline.
Exactly.
Yeah.
There was no placebo group sitting in a similar quiet room taking a sugar pill to compare against. Plus, the volunteers were highly selected based on their willingness to participate in a psychedelic trial.
Oh, so they were already pretty open-minded people.
Right. And their expectations were astronomical. They walked into that facility fully expecting to experience a chemical breakthrough.
So the environment alone was doing heavy lifting.
Huge amounts of heavy lifting. What's fascinating here is that the study perfectly demonstrates what is possible in human problem solving when conditions are perfectly aligned to support deep, uninterrupted thought.
It shows the absolute ceiling of what a motivated mind can do.
Yes. But from a strict causal scientific standpoint,
mm-hmm.
it fails to prove the drug itself was the primary mechanism. It just shows a correlation within a highly optimized setting.
Right. Because to figure out if the molecule is the actual lever pulling the strings of creativity, modern scientists realize they had a massive measurement problem.
Oh, yeah. Measuring creativity is a nightmare.
You can't just put a vague subjective concept like creativity under a microscope.
No, you really can't.
So to test causation, these researchers had to break the psychology of human creativity down into discrete, measurable components.
Exactly, because creativity is not a localized switch in the brain. It's not a single function you can just turn on and off. It is a complex, multi-stage process that requires two completely different and honestly somewhat contradictory modes of cognitive processing.
And this is where the concepts of divergent thinking and convergent thinking become critical to understanding the actual data.
Yes. You have to understand both to make sense of any of this.
The OTW Journal uses this classic brick analogy for divergent thinking, which I love.
Oh, that's a great thought experiment.
So imagine you are handed a standard red brick, and you're told to list every possible use for it in 2 minutes.
Okay.
Divergent thinking is pure idea generation. It is scored on volume, like how many ideas you generate, and originality, how unusual those ideas are.
Right. So saying you could use the brick as a doorstop or a paperweight.
That's a low originality, obvious answer.
Great. Anyone would think of that.
But realizing you could grind the brick down into a fine powder and use the red dust as a pigment to paint a mural, that is a highly original divergent thought.
Exactly. Because divergent thinking is expansive. It is the process of opening the brain's search space as wide as physically possible, scanning for distant, non-obvious associations.
Right.
It requires dropping your assumptions about what a brick is, quote unquote, supposed to be used for.
It reminds me of a wild, completely unstructured jazz jam session, you know?
Oh, that's a good way to look at it.
You just have musicians in a room playing off each other, throwing out notes, and fundamentally, there are no bad ideas.
Yeah.
You are just generating raw, chaotic material.
Just seeing what happens.
Yeah. But a jam session doesn't usually result in a polished, multi-track studio album. You eventually need the second cognitive mode.
You need convergent thinking.
Right.
If divergent thinking is idea generation, convergent thinking is idea selection. It is the discernment phase.
The editing phase, basically.
Exactly. It's the cold, analytical process of taking all that wild raw material you generated, evaluating it against the constraints of reality, and zeroing in on the single correct or absolute best answer.
Like solving a complex algebra equation? That's pure convergent thinking.
Right.
There aren't 20 creative answers to an algebra problem.
Right.
There's one right answer, and you need rigid discipline to find it.
So when modern researchers finally began conducting a double-blind, placebo-controlled trials to isolate the chemical effects of psychedelics from that 1960s retreat environment.
They looked at both of these modes.
They did. And the findings present a very specific, very consistent pattern.
Okay.
The administration of psychedelics, even at sub-perceptual microdoses, does provide a small, statistically significant lift to the originality of divergent thinking.
So people do generate ideas that are quantifiably less obvious and more novel.
Yes. The brick becomes the paint pigment.
But the data on convergent problem solving goes in the exact opposite direction.
It absolutely tanks.
Yeah. The research shows these compounds do not reliably improve your ability to find the single correct answer. In fact, when looking at acute higher doses, the data shows they actively impair focused reasoning.
Right.
Finding the right answer actually becomes significantly harder in the moment.
The brain is so flooded with novel associations and loosened constraints that the analytical discipline required to, you know, prune those ideas away and select the viable one is totally compromised.
Think about the practical application of this in your own job. Like, if you are an architectural engineer designing a bridge, you want divergent thinking on day one.
Sure, you want it to look amazing.
Right, you want a massive brainstorm to make the bridge look breathtaking and unique. But on day 30, when you have to calculate the load-bearing stress of the steel cables so the bridge doesn't collapse into the river under the weight of traffic,
you absolutely need convergent thinking.
The math has to be perfect.
Yeah, you don't want a creative math equation for a bridge.
Yeah, exactly. The science implies these compounds hand you the wild generative spark, but they actively temporarily disable the disciplined answer-finding mechanism you need to actually finish the job safely.
This raises an important question, though. If the molecule is reliably enhancing the expansive divergent process while simultaneously degrading the analytical convergent process,
we have to look into the hood.
Right. We need to examine what is happening within the physical architecture of the brain to cause that highly specific psychological outcome.
The neuroscience here is wild. The primary mechanism of action centers on a specific serotonin receptor in the brain, right? The 5-HT2A receptor.
Yes, the 5-HT2A receptor.
And when the psychedelic molecule enters the brain and binds to this receptor, it triggers this cascade of effects that alter the brain's normal day-to-day hierarchical structures.
And the most critical structure altered in this process is the default mode network, or the DMN.
The DMN.
To understand why quieting the DMN boosts divergent thinking, you have to understand what the DMN does during your normal waking life.
Right. What is its day job?
It is essentially the brain's main routing hub and rigid filter.
It's the system that lights up on an fMRI scan when you're daydreaming, right?
Yeah.
Or ruminating on the past, worrying about the future.
Exactly. It contains your sense of self, your ego.
Right.
It acts as an internal manager that dictates how information flows between different regions of the brain. You have to remember, the brain is an incredibly energy-hungry organ.
Oh, yeah. It uses a ton of calories.
So to save energy, it relies heavily on predicting the world based on past experiences. And the DMN maintains those predictions. It keeps your thoughts orderly, efficient, and bound by your learned assumptions.
So in the context of creativity, the DMN is your inner critic.
Precisely. It is the voice that says, a brick is for building walls. Don't waste energy thinking about grinding it into paint.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting.
Let's hear it.
Imagine your brain is a highly structured traditional corporate office.
Okay, I like this.
The default mode network is the strict, no-nonsense office manager. This manager ensures that the marketing department stays in their designated cubicles and only communicates with other marketing personnel.
Accounting only talks to accounting.
Exactly. IT only talks to IT. It is an incredibly efficient, predictable, and safe way to run a business.
But maybe a bit boring.
Right. But when that 5-HT2A receptor is activated, it effectively fires the strict office manager.
The manager is gone.
The rigid walls drop. The hierarchical rules dissolve. And what you get is a chaotic, high-energy office party.
Right.
Suddenly, the head of marketing is in the break room having a bizarre, deep conversation with the lead accountant. And they are both mingling with the janitorial staff. Regions of the brain that almost never communicate with each other directly are suddenly sharing information.
The visual representations of this on functional MRI scans are just striking.
They really are beautiful to look at.
A normal brain scan shows very distinct, heavily trafficked neural pathways, like information flowing along well-worn highways. But under the influence of a psychedelic, those rigid highways disintegrate, and the brain explodes with a massive web of new cross-cortical connections.
Everything's talking to everything else.
Exactly. And this physical reality forms the basis of the entropic brain theory, which is a major framework pioneered by the researcher Robin Carhart-Harris.
And entropy, just to clarify for everyone, in the realm of physics and thermodynamics, is a measure of disorder, randomness, or uncertainty within a system.
Right. And Carhart-Harris applies that physical concept directly to human consciousness. The standard adult waking brain operates in a low entropy state.
meaning it's highly ordered, predictable, rigid.
Exactly. When the DMN is quieted by a psychedelic, the brain transitions into a high entropy state. The activity becomes less predictable, far more disordered, and highly flexible.
The mind is no longer chained to its habitual assumptions.
Because the strict office manager isn't there to enforce the rules, the brain starts reaching for much more distant associations.
It stops taking its usual filters seriously.
Right. And this high entropy state is the physical engine of divergent thinking. It is the exact biological state required to look at a brick and see painting pigment.
The distant connections create novel combinations.
They do.
But this brings us right back to the double-edged sword. The loosened filters, the chaotic corporate office party, they are the precise reason convergent thinking suffers.
You cannot sit down and solve complex calculus at a wild party where everyone is shouting new ideas at you.
Exactly. The chemical activation widens the search space for new ideas, but it inherently blurs the focus aim required to execute them.
So this mechanism makes perfect sense for acute higher doses where the subjective effects are undeniable.
Right. If you take a macro dose, you are going to feel it.
But that brings us to the most pervasive modern trend, microdosing.
Yes. The Silicon Valley protocol of taking tiny, subperceptual amounts of these compounds every few days.
The whole point of a microdose is that you're not supposed to feel it working.
Right. You go about your normal workday.
So if the dose is microscopic, does this massive uncoupling of the default mode network still happen? Or is the perceived creative boost coming from somewhere else entirely?
The rigorous clinical data on microdosing presents a major challenge to the cultural lore here.
It really does.
When researchers conduct modern double-blind trials on subperceptual doses, the pharmacological effects are remarkably subtle.
Very subtle. They are heavily dependent on individual biological variables too, like baseline neurochemistry, body mass, prior exposure to psychedelics.
The actual measurable lift in divergent thinking is far, far smaller than you would assume based on all those glowing reports from enthusiast communities on Reddit.
Right. The OHOTW journal highlights a massive complicating factor in measuring microdosing, and it's the placebo effect.
Oh, this part of the study is so good.
And the way researchers finally isolated this is brilliant. They used a methodology known as self-blinding citizen science.
I love how they did this. Because conducting a traditional clinical trial is incredibly expensive.
You're very expensive.
And bringing people into a sterile lab environment immediately spikes their expectations because they know they are being studied.
The environment ruins the data.
Exactly. So to bypass this, researchers designed a study that participants could execute in their own homes, in their normal working environments, while remaining entirely blind to what they were ingesting.
The logistics of the self-blinding setup are just ingenious.
They really are. So if you are participating at home, you take your standard microdose capsules, then you create an identical set of placebo capsules, just completely empty pills that look exactly the same.
Right.
You place the active capsules and the empty capsules into separate envelopes. You put unique QR codes on the envelopes, shuffle them all up so you completely lose track of which is which, and you draw from them over a period of weeks.
And you scan the QR code before you take the pill.
Right, which tells the researcher's database what you actually swallowed. But you, the participant, have absolutely no idea if you are taking the molecule or just a blank.
It is a remarkable way to maintain a naturalistic setting while completely controlling for expectation.
And the results.
The results of these self-blinding studies were profound. The data revealed that a massive proportion of the reported benefits, you know, the sudden spikes in creativity, the heightened mood, the ease of divergent thinking, they were present in the participants who only believed they had taken the active drug.
Wait, really?
Yes. The empty placebo capsules generated many of the exact same cognitive improvements as the actual microdoses.
So are we looking at a scenario where highly paid tech engineers and professional artists are basically taking complicated sugar pills, experiencing a placebo effect, and tricking themselves into a state of higher creative output?
Well, it is a complex interaction. The researchers are careful to clarify that it is not purely an illusion.
Okay, that's fair.
There is a small, genuine pharmacological effect occurring on top of the placebo baseline. But the self-blinding methodology proves that the psychological weight of expectancy is doing an enormous amount of the heavy lifting.
If we connect this to the bigger picture.
We often talk about set and setting, you know, mindset and physical environment as the crucial variables for a full psychedelic experience.
Right.
The data shows set and setting are just as vital for microdosing.
The ritual itself has psychological power. Just waking up in the morning, setting a specific intention, and swallowing a capsule with the deep-seated belief that I have just taken a compound that dissolves my mental blocks and makes me more creative.
That deeply held belief physically shifts a person's psychological framework. It changes how they approach a blank page, how they react to frustration, how they perceive their own output.
By believing the pill has quieted their inner critic, they effectively grant themselves the permission to be expansive and divergent.
The expectation manifests the reality.
Wow. Okay, before we pull all these threads together, we have to pause for a strict reality check.
Okay.
The OTW Journal includes a comprehensive medical disclaimer in their analysis, and it is vital we convey that to you. We are analyzing complex neuroscience and a pervasive cultural phenomenon here. However, these are highly potent controlled substances in most jurisdictions globally.
Right. They're illegal in many places.
And more critically, they carry severe biological risks for certain populations. The research specifically flags that individuals with a personal or family history of psychotic disorders, schizophrenia, or bipolar disorder face significant dangers, as these compounds can trigger severe adverse psychiatric events.
It's very serious.
This analysis is strictly an educational exploration of the scientific literature. It is not a recommendation, an endorsement, or medical advice to seek out or use psychedelics.
The clinical context is non-negotiable. The science is measuring mechanisms, not issuing broad prescriptions for cognitive enhancement.
Absolutely. So, looking at the entire landscape of the data, the 1966 professional breakthroughs, the strict division between divergent and convergent thinking, the quieting of the default mode network into this entropic state, and the massive influence of placebo and expectancy in microdosing, what is the definitive verdict?
The big question.
Do these compounds actually make a human being more creative?
The science shows that psychedelics perform a very real, very specific cognitive function under the right conditions. They act as a solvent for rigid thought patterns.
Exulfant.
They lower the psychological fear of failure and inhibition that so often bottleneck the creative process. They force the brain to surface unexpected distant associations, providing the conscious mind with highly novel raw material. But they are not a mechanical switch that guarantees genius. They do not replace the fundamental requirement of acquired skill.
The explainer closes with a fantastic metaphor that synthesizes this perfectly. They note that the molecule might successfully quiet the inner critic guarding the door to your ideas. It can widen the space of possibility.
It can expand the canvas.
Exactly. But the molecule cannot paint the painting.
No. If you have never spent 1,000 hours learning to play the piano, quieting your default mode network will not suddenly allow you to compose a masterpiece.
Right. You won't just magically become Mozart.
It will just result in highly uninhibited, chaotic noise.
Mm.
The discipline, the years of honed craft, and the sheer analytical hard work required to take a wild, divergent idea and refine it into a finished piece of art or a functioning mathematical theorem.
That rests entirely on the individual.
Entirely.
So what does this all mean for you? Whether you are trying to write a novel, develop a marketing strategy, or solve a stubborn logistical problem at work. True creative output requires you to master and honor both sides of your cognition.
You need both.
You must give yourself the grace to be wild, unstructured, and divergent. You have to let the marketing department talk to accounting.
Have the office party.
Right. But you also have to cultivate the fierce, sober discipline to sit down when the brainstorm is over, filter through the noise, and converge on the final viable answer. You need the untamed spark, but you absolutely require the disciplined hand to tend the fire.
You know, the science we have reviewed today leaves us with a deeply provocative philosophical question.
Oh.
The self-blinding citizen science studies demonstrated that a massive portion of the creative breakthrough comes entirely from the placebo effect.
Right, the sugar pill effect.
It stems from the mere belief and intention that your inner critic has been chemically silenced.
The expectation is unlocking the door, not just the chemistry.
Exactly. So what does that reveal about the psychological cages we construct for ourselves every single day?
Oh, wow.
If ritual, focus, intention, and expectancy alone carry the power to lower your inhibitions and simulate that flexible, entropic brain state, it implies the key is already in the lock. Is it possible that you could design your own completely sober, personalized psychological ritual to temporarily bypass your default mode network and access your own distant, wild associations without needing a molecule at all?
That shifts the entire paradigm. I mean, the magic might just be the act of giving yourself the permission you assume you needed a pill to obtain.
Something to think about.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the mechanics of the creative mind. Keep questioning the cultural myths, keep exploring your own cognitive potential, and have a great rest of your day.